because I've been fighting something that has been a little bit problematic for me this past week, but I think we'll be okay. I have a question to get us started. How good is your vision? Proud eyeglass owners, hold up your eyeglasses. Prescription eyeglasses. This is not prescription. This is just to make me look cool. Let's see, those eyeglasses, okay. Contact owners, contacts, anybody wearing contacts? Few of us. Does anybody naturally just have excellent vision, no aid? Look, oh, we got a couple. 2020s? Oh, 2020s in the hand. Alice, raise your hand. Look at that. Everybody look jealously at them.
What about readers?
Readers? You know, I'm a fan of whatever helps us to see more clearly. Have you ever seen the videos? This is, if you watch these videos on social media and you don't erupt into joy, you don't have a heart. These videos of these infants receiving their first pair of glasses. Yeah. Have you seen those kind of videos? Oh my gosh. Talk about just melting your heart. That look of joy when you can see clearly. Right? So we're talking about vision this morning, but I want to go beyond just the vision of our two ocular nerves connected to our brain, because we rely so strongly on this vision. And I want to ask, how good are we at seeing ourselves? That was the question we started with in pre-talk and had some great conversation. How good are we at witnessing ourselves, seeing ourselves as we really are? Yesterday was Litha in the Pagan Wheel of the Year, also known in Swedish as Midsommar, which is a neat word to say and an interesting movie to watch if you've seen that movie. We're in the middle of a transition, but this is marking the moment of the longest day and the shortest night of the year. It's not too much of a stretch, metaphorically speaking, to think about what extra daylight, what extra sunlight reveals, how it shines the light on parts of ourselves that we didn't know were there. Solstice is a metaphor that we can step into for expanded awareness. Everything is lit. Everything is seen. Everything is exposed in the light of day. The title of my talk, which kind of went through a few evolutions, but what I landed on was New Ways of Seeing. And it's about embracing new ways of seeing here at the solstice. Can we, like hundreds of generations of our ancestors before us, can we take the moment in this planetary trajectory as we're spinning on this globe in space, orbiting the sun, can we take the moment to pause and with the Earth shine the light on ourselves a bit and see what is revealed? We're talking about illuminating new ways of seeing today. This is part of a psychedelic summer series. We started out the first week talking about the root words of psychedelic, psyche, mind or soul, and Dalen, the expanded awareness, the revealing power. Psychedelic, mind expanding, mind revealing, soul opening. What do we see when we turn on the lights? What do we see when we shine the light of awareness on the parts of ourselves, those hidden corners and recesses where all the dust bunnies accumulate, and those parts of ourselves where we haven't moved the furniture in a long time and we're not quite ready to go in there and look at what might be there? What do we see when we turn on the lights? Here in this season, we don't just celebrate the light. We celebrate what the light reveals. We reflect on what it reveals. The first quote from Stanislav Grof, who is a psychedelic researcher, author, he said that psychedelics used responsibly with proper caution would be for psychiatry what the microscope is for biology and medicine, and the telescope is for astronomy. Researchers that have worked with psychedelic substances have recognized that it has the potential to magnify parts of ourselves that we may not see. And just like you need a microscope or an X-ray or an MRI, we need external tools to see parts of ourselves that we can't see with our own eyes. And if you're an astronomer, if you look through a telescope, you're magnifying and bringing in all the available light that you can across the spectrum to see things you can't see with your naked eye. And psychedelic substances or experiences, and we're talking about both of those because we're not saying you have to have or take a psychedelic substance to achieve this level of vision and reflection. But it's important to know that these substances, and the researchers who study them with the intention not of saying, here's a cool drug to take to a party or to a concert. But why is it that there are substances on this planet that we came from, things that have grown out of the ground, that have the ability to interact with our neurochemistry, to cause some rewiring to take place? What is it that they're doing? What is it that they're revealing? But more importantly, what are we doing about what we see? And that's what I want to talk about this morning. Seeing is not just in and of itself the end goal. As a matter of fact, I would say there's quite a few people who have utilized psychedelic substances or experiences in a very human way, which is, wow, that was fascinating, and then we go on and we move on with our life, right? Like, I remember when Beth went and saw the U2 at the Sphere, we were talking about that. Like, seeing something so mind-blowing, we have the ability as humans to witness things that blow our minds. And then what do we do next? We're hungry, and so we're trying to find a Taco Bell to eat at. We can take these transformative experiences and we can walk away and not integrate them into our lives. Why are we so bad at seeing things, and why are we so bad at acting on what we see? So first I want to start, let's get some of the bad news out of the way first. I want to talk about why we're so bad at seeing things naturally on our own, unaided. Even with all that light, we know that as human beings, we're not good at seeing inside. We have this aspect of ourselves that we even have a name for. It's called blind spots. We have parts of ourselves that are not naturally visible or aware to us. I'm a big fan of, in neurological and developmental terms, the list, ever-growing list. I think at one point, I think there's somewhere around 50 or more cognitive biases, if you're familiar with some of these cognitive biases, like the confirmation bias is one that's most familiar to us. We will naturally seek out information to confirm what we already know and believe, and we will discount information that runs counter to what we have experienced in the past. That's a cognitive bias. There's parts of our brain that have almost like these bugs, software bugs, that through time and evolution have created us with this, gifted us this powerful processing computer called a brain. But it has some natural bugs. We have parts of ourselves we don't see clearly because of the way that these cognitive biases or these logical fallacies show themselves. The Dunning-Kruger effect is another well-known example of that, which is the less we know about something, the more confident we are. It's pretty weird. We start, and if you look at a chart of the Dunning-Kruger chart, when you look at knowledge compared to actual confidence, we often start learning about new things. And as we learn, our confidence skyrockets. And so in the very beginning, when we're learning a new skill set, we learn all these things and we're acquiring this information, and then we think we are more competent than we actually are. And the further along we go, those of you who have been on this journey of learning, maybe you've pursued higher education, you have a doctorate or a PhD in something, probably somewhere along the line, you went from the heights of confidence to, at a certain point, you realize the things I know are about this big, but the things I don't know are huge. And as you begin to get into that subject, that field, you realize there's a lot more I don't know than what I do know. And your confidence goes down tremendously. And you begin to encounter people who say things like, well, I can give you my best opinion, but we're still learning about this, and there's still a lot that we don't know. As a matter of fact, the most intelligent people are the ones who, over time, recognize their own human fallible limitations and say that our ability to see and reflect is greatly diminished by these biases. The confirmation bias I mentioned as well, which is that we seek information to confirm what we already know. The other one I'll mention is the introspection illusion that we all fall prey to, which is that we think we know our own minds, our own selves. Who should better understand me than me? I live with me. I spend all the time with me. And we think that we know ourselves so well. But the introspection illusion tells us that much of our thinking is, in fact, subconscious. It happens at an automated level. Last week, Allison Paradise, who had a fascinating talk with so much to digest and think about, kind of hit on this a little bit. And I mentioned, I think I included in the email recap that went out, a book that really, really messed with me by Robert Saplansky a year or two back called Determined, The Science Behind the Fallacy of Free Will, how we can fool ourselves into thinking that we are the master and commander of this ship called us. We are in supreme control of our psyche. We make our decisions with full autonomy, whereas we know that we can delude ourselves into thinking we know ourselves so much better than we can. And in reality, we need help to truly see ourselves. We need help to increase our vision. Ram Dass in his book, Polishing the Mirror, and that book is such a great resource if anybody wants to dive a little bit deeper into this conversation. Ram Dass uses the metaphor of polishing the mirror as this idea of saying there are parts of ourselves that we can't see until we take the time to scrub away and remove some of the gunk that's there. It's like walking into your RV after it's been in storage and looking in the mirror and saying, holy cow, do I really look like that? And you're like, oh, okay, it was just some dust on it. We all have dust, metaphorical dust, that accumulates on the mirror of our vision. and Ram Dass says in his book, Polishing the Mirror, that we have to take the time, we have to do the work to see more clearly. He says, motivations and desires affect our perceptions. Our motivations and desires, they affect our perceptions. We don't necessarily see things as they are. We see them as we are. We don't necessarily see things as they are. We see them as we are, or sometimes how we want them to be. We are so skilled at fooling ourselves, at deluding ourselves into thinking that we are something other than who we really are and what we really are. And as human beings, we frequently move through life at such a breakneck pace. Myself first and foremost. It's so easy to just fly through life and to go from thing to thing. And we need times to stop and to do a gut check, to turn that flashlight inward in some introspection. And the psychedelic experience should be and has been at its best exactly that. A way of changing our perceptions, of removing some of those hazy things that we put up in front of ourselves to see ourselves the way we want to see ourselves instead of the way that we really are. So we know we're really, really bad at seeing things clearly. The other piece of unfortunate news is that even when we can see something clearly, we're also bad at acting on the things that we see. Just because you've climbed a mountain and sat at the feet of a guru and have meditated for 10 years and have developed this sense of equanimity and peace, and if you ascend the mountaintop and the guru tells you that piece of information, that piece of wisdom that only you needed to hear, and you come down the mountain, your face alights like Moses. What do you do with that? That is the work of integration. We're not going to talk about that as much this morning, but that word is incredibly important. I would say supremely important when it comes to any psychedelic experience or any mind-manifesting process that we go through. Whatever retreat you've been to, a silent retreat or a meditation thing or a pilgrimage or whatever guru you've paid money to go see or whatever new book you've read, whatever thing it is that you have just laid it on, there's the work, but the harder work is what do we do with what we know. When the light reveals, what do we do with what we see? When I was 9 or 10, my mom was driving, and as you did in the 80s and 90s there, you didn't really take the whole seatbelt thing super seriously because it was kind of like, you know, not cool as a kid, right? And I learned how cool a seatbelt was when my mom had to stopped quickly and she rear-ended somebody, and I had my feet on the front dashboard of the front seat, as you do when you're driving, right? And I slid down and my right front shin broke. Now, imagine if you will, as you can see, I'm standing on it, and the only effects I have from that is that because I was still growing at the time when they set it, my right foot kind of set with what's called a torsal twist. So this foot out at a 45 is straight for me. That feels straight. But imagine, if you will, that had I gone to the hospital and they take the x-rays and they show my parents, you know, here's what's happened. Here's this bone that is broken and we need to do this and this. Now imagine if you took that x-ray and my parents, being so proud as they were of me, printed that x-ray and framed and hung it on the wall. And then as I grew up, I began to identify with that broken leg, and I talked about it. As a matter of fact, it was the part of my entrance exam into university as I wrote this beautiful essay about my broken leg. But the entire time, I never took the steps to set the leg. We would call that ludicrous. To know that there is a part of ourselves that is broken, but then to do nothing about it. It would be just as ludicrous to hang that x-ray on the wall and to talk about the x-ray and do nothing, and yet we do that all the time in our life, don't we? If I had to ask you how many things about yourself that you're working on that you know you need to change, you could probably come up with that list pretty quickly. We know the parts of ourselves that the light needs to shine on and where we need work to be done. But moving from knowing to doing, that's where the real work comes in. I'm going to use an example from my faith origins in Christianity, and I'm going to take a verse out of context, but I think it's okay. I think James will forgive me. In James chapter 1, James talked about this principle of seeing and doing. And he used it talking about being a hearer of the word and a doer of the word. We're going to take that concept of the word and the Bible and the revelation, all that stuff like that. We're going to set that aside for a moment because the principle that he was talking about is one that is still applicable. Because in James 1:24, he says, if anyone is a hearer of the word, so in this case, we'll replace the word with, if anyone is a hearer of the truth, if you're a hearer of the truth and not a doer, he is like a man, and we'll keep the gender-specific language in there because it was very appropriate for James. And I also think because this is probably more true of men anyway. He is like a man who looks intently at his face in the mirror, James says, and then he walks away and forgets what manner of man he was. Have you ever done that? Have you ever looked at yourself in the mirror and you're like, oh my gosh, what is that on my face? And then something happened, you walk away, and then you forget all about it. James says, this is what we do when we delude ourselves. There's nothing magical or inherently powerful about vision, about seeing, unless we take what we see and integrate it and grow. There are just as many deluded people out there who have had mind-blowing psychedelic experiences that are just as selfish and angry and hateful and bitter. Because the substance, the experience, the seeing doesn't do anything inherently in and of itself. If I could promise to give you a pill that would reveal the true you, to show you the real you without all of the external forms. And if you took that pill, there's absolutely no guarantee your life would change. Because simply knowing what the light reveals is part of where change happens. But we have to act on it. Many people look to psychedelics and psychedelic experiences as a quick fix or as an easy way to address things that are just tough. Because changing takes time, and we don't like things that take time, do we? If you could have a psychedelic experience and do in a week or so what would take years of therapy, of course we're interested in that. And there is that potential there for sure. But where it comes to all of us here in this room, we all have psychedelic, mind-opening, mind-revealing, soul-revealing experiences all the time that we miss. Because, to use Ram Dass's metaphor, we haven't polished the mirror sufficiently. We haven't spent the time at not just looking at what's there, but deciding what we do with what is there. And if we're going to land somewhere really simply this morning, I would say that where we're landing is realizing that there are parts of ourselves that require an elevated level of consciousness to address. What do I mean by that? When we talk about elevated or altered states of consciousness, it's very easy to get into the woo-woo and weird really quick. But simply speaking, if you're lost and in the woods, we'll use the example, because I appreciate Charity's reference of the Lord of the Rings, the signal fires of Gondor. That was fantastic. So I just recently reread The Hobbit, and I'm now going back and rewatching the Hobbit trilogy, right? So when they're in the forest of Mirkwood and they're lost and they're confused because the forest is like filtering and clouding their perception, Bilbo says, I'm going to climb this tree so I can see. And as he breaks above the cover, he gets a breath of fresh air and he could see the Lonely Mountain. He could see where they're at. And in the same way, there are experiences, there are processes, there are things that we do to give us that elevated, higher state of consciousness. We do that through silence, through mindfulness and meditation. We do that through the sacred work of therapy, direction and spiritual matters, of walking alongside of difficult things with people we trust in a safe space. We do those things because we want to get a higher point of view. We want to elevate our consciousness so that we can do the deeper work. I asked in pre-talk when we started how good are you at seeing yourself? And what we found is that over time we get better at seeing the parts of ourselves that need work, but we also get better at talking ourselves out of the change that needs to happen too, don't we? We can get older and wiser, and we can also get older and more stubborn, more entrenched in the parts of ourselves. That's why Alexander Shulgin, who was a chemist, he was known as the godfather of psychedelics, one of the godfathers of psychedelics. He's written about it a lot. He synthesized and studied hundreds of psychedelic compounds, specifically for the purpose of working with his patients who were experiencing all forms of treatment resistance, depression, anxiety, and other things. And Alexander Shulgin said, what is most important about psychedelics is not the psychedelic experience itself. What is most important is not the psychedelic experience itself, but what you do with it afterwards. How you integrate it. Psychedelics and psychedelic experiences are excellent at revealing the roots of the issues we face. In the coming weeks, I'll hopefully share some more personal stories about some of my experiences and some of the things that came up, and I will be the first to beat the drum of how important psychedelic substances can be within the mental health field, within the therapy field. We're just now discovering so many potential uses and helps for those who have struggled. If you haven't read How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan or watched the Netflix series of the same name, you'll realize there is a lot of potential there. But as Alexander Shulgin said, it's not the experience itself that is doing the work. The real hard work is afterwards, what do? And psychedelic researchers now say that the more intense the experience, the deeper the things that are dredged up, the longer you need to spend in integration. There are some people who only have one psychedelic experience, and that is enough, and they spend their entire lifetime unpacking that. But these experiences and these things that are available to everyone, no substances needed, these psychedelic mind-opening experiences are things, they're invitations for us to elevate our consciousness, to bring our level of awareness up, to get a higher perspective. They shine the light on our inner wounds and our patterns, our illusions of separation, our untapped creativity, insight, and compassion. Some truths are only available to us in the light of higher consciousness. And that's what I'd like to leave with you today. As you're thinking, how do I change? How do I continue to grow and be this person that I am in this world? How do I bring this best version of myself to a world that is so hurting? How can I engage with the people I love without these parts of myself, these shadow parts that keep emerging? There are some things that need to be revealed in the light of full consciousness. And only you know what that means for you. I'll leave you with this last quote, which is another excerpt from Ram Dass from Polishing the Mirror. Said that one way to get free of attachment is to cultivate a witness consciousness. This is something I know we'll probably be getting into more in the mindfulness meditation group. If you spend any amount of time in mindfulness meditation or in some Buddhist circles, this idea of the witness perspective or this witness consciousness is a non-judgmental way of seeing. It's a way of seeing that kind of polishes the mirror and removes the judgments that we oftentimes put in front of what we see. He says, one way to get free of attachment is to cultivate the witness consciousness, to become a neutral observer of your own life, to bring a neutral but curious awareness. Huh, why did I just respond that way? Huh, that was interesting. What does that mean? What was coming up there? The witness place inside of you is simple awareness. And if you remember from when Ken talked a little bit ago, this idea of awareness and attention, it's the same thing. The light of awareness is what we shine inward when we're doing this inner work. This place within you is simple awareness, the part of you that is aware of everything. Just noticing, watching, not judging, just being present, being here now. The witness, he says, is actually another level of consciousness. So my hope for you and for me is that we can embrace the full light of this solstice season that we're in. And then we ask, what is it that the light is revealing in you right now? As you spend time working on settling into that witness, non-judgmental consciousness, what is it that the light is revealing for you right now? And what are you going to do about it? How are you going to integrate that knowledge? What does that mean for you? It's what I call the so what and the now what. You've just had a great psychedelic experience. Fantastic. So what? You had this experience. Now what? What are you going to do? How then shall we live? That's the work that we're doing. These are the conversations that we're having that bring about that change. Thank you.